Hello, I'm Justin Rowlatt. Welcome to the download of Business Daily. In the programme today, the colonial era may be over, but does foreign investment in Africa represent a new land grab?
I'm very worried about many of them. Many of the deals have been struck without proper consultation, without recognising who the owners really are.
Investment companies say African agribusiness can generate huge profits. We ask what the risks are.
The World Bank has underwritten our assets for political risk.
The World Bank has given you some kind of insurance against the government changing and the attitudes towards you changing.
Correct.
That's all in the Business Daily podcast from the BBC. Food prices matter to us all. Of course they do. Food is the stuff of life itself. But the less money you have, the higher the proportion of your income you spend on food. So food prices matter more to the poor. And that means food prices are a particular issue in Africa. Bear that in mind when you take a look at the latest table of world food prices, which the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization produces. It charts the real price of food over the past couple of decades, and it shows a dramatic change. You've got almost 20 years of pretty stable prices, and then up they go, rising steeply. They drop back a bit, and then up again. A bit like Mount Kilimanjaro, rising in all its forbidding majesty out of the great African plain. What it's showing is that food prices in recent years have been historically very high, over double the average of the past couple of decades. But here's where the comparison with Kilimanjaro fails, because there is no sign of any significant drop in food prices. So why are food prices so high, and will they ever fall back? Kostas Stamoulis is the director of the FAO's Agricultural Development Economics Division.
We are looking at hopefully a better year this year than we did last year in terms of world food prices.
Well, I bet you are. Last year was one of the highest years on record for food prices, wasn't
it? Actually, the prices peaked in February and they've broke a record. It's correct. But we had a record crop and we have much better inventories. And so this, if Mother Nature makes sure that what is planted, the corresponding part is harvested. I think we are looking into a better year with lower prices, not significantly lower, but lower prices than last year, and possibly more stable.
Most people seem to think the long-term trend for food prices kind of inexorably upwards.
That is absolutely correct.
So why? Why is food going up? Normally, I mean, when you learn in basic economics that food prices are inelastic, and what normally happens is prices go up very quickly when there's shortages, then people overproduce in reaction, and because it's inelastic, prices fall very dramatically, and you get these volatile cycles of price rises and falls. That doesn't seem to be happening anymore. Prices seem to be going one direction, more or less, and that's up.
Let's see, on the demand side, lots of countries which are low and middle income are growing and their populations are changing their diets and they're shifting from direct consumption of cereals to more high value things.
You mean eating meat, okay, and you need more agricultural land to grow grains to feed animals than you do just to grow grains to feed humans, yeah?
Right. We have demand is increasing. Now, we're also looking at paying some of the sins of the past because yield growth is not projected to be as strong as it was in the past. We need investments, we need policies, we need adoption of technologies, etc. We need incentives for the farmers to actually adopt those technologies, and we need better farm prices. I have no incentive of adopting.
You just told me that prices are on the way up. I mean, they're going to get those better prices. I mean, that's the other side. We pay more for our food. The farmers get more for what they grow and raise.
That's an excellent point, but you see, not always high world prices reach the poor farmers in the hinterland of Africa. So we have to also look at world prices vis-a-vis local prices going to farmers, prices paid by urban consumers. Those are not necessarily the same thing, and neither they vary together, harmoniously. So we have to be a little bit careful here.
Kostas Stamoulis, director of the FAO's Agricultural Development Economics Division. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Justin Rowlatt. So Kostas Stamoulis of the FAO believes that high world prices, which might increase incomes for poor farmers in Africa, don't necessarily always reach them. Yet Africa is reckoned to offer the best opportunities for increasing world output of food. And the UN estimates that, with the population expected to increase by 2 billion by 2050, food production needs to increase by 70%. So what role will Africa play in this, and what can Africa's governments do to further African agricultural productivity? So Gordon Conway of Imperial College London is the chair of the Montpellier panel, a group of experts focused on ideas for enabling better European government support of sub-Saharan African agricultural development. The group has just published a report called Opportunities in African Agriculture. So first off, I asked Sir Gordon how pressing it is that the world increases food production.
It's pretty urgent. We've got to increase food production simply because there's going to be more people. So we've got to increase it by a third just for that reason alone. But incomes are changing, particularly emerging countries, and their diets are changing. So they're eating more meat and more eggs and so on and so forth. And you need to produce more grain to feed the cows and pigs and chickens and so on. On top of that, you've got competition with biofuels. You've got increasing fertilizer prices, increasing fuel prices. You've got degradation of land and water. And you've got, of course, climate change and all the threats from that.
But implied in your answer is there are going to be huge problems with doing that. I mean, where is this increase in production going to come from?
Well, most of it, I'm afraid, is going to come from the existing land. There's a lot of talk about lots of empty land. I don't believe it. If you look at the figures for all the crops, the hectareage, the amount of land grown for grain crops or vegetables or root crops, has remained absolutely constant since 1960. Now, if there's this enormous pressure on land, why hasn't the amount of land increased? And I think there are real limitations on how much land you can bring into arable growth.
Well, hold on a second. There are lots of African countries in the process of leasing vast tracts of land that they claim is unused. So I've just been in Sierra Leone, for example. Yeah, in Sierra Leone, something like a fifth of the land area of Sierra Leone is being tendered for leases, for these long 50-year leases, to be developed into kind of agribusinesses.
Now, I understand that, but I think most of this land already has people who claim some ownership to it. It may be underutilized. I'm sure that's true, that you could intensify agriculture on the land. But the notion that there's somehow absolutely empty land, apart from the rainforests of the Congo, which we don't want to cut down for good climate change reasons, I don't think there's a lot of empty land to come in. I think there's some.
So then there's a question about who improves the land, who's responsible for improving the land. And the model at the moment for many African countries seems to be bringing in foreign companies, foreign capital. Does that work?
No, well, let's come to that question. But first of all, one needs to understand that 80% of the farmers in Africa are smallholders with less than 2 hectares. You have to focus on them because that's where the engine of growth is going to be in food production. Now, in addition to that, you do need some large farms. There's no doubt about that. But it's a question about who owns the farms. Is it foreign money or is it local money? And secondly, how are they configured? The ideal, I think, is one that was pioneered in Malaysia 50 years ago, which is that you have a central estate, if you like, central, really big farm, which does the processing, brings in the inputs. And all around it are smallholders brought together in cooperatives. And you have to have cooperatives with the biggest state, otherwise they get, you know,
overwhelmed,
and taken for. So,
I mean, there is another model, which is the model that happened in Britain, model of the enclosures, where big farms were forced upon the peasantry, and those big farms then became much more efficient. I mean, that's the model that, frankly, Africa seems to be following at the moment in selling off these vast tracts of land to these agribusinesses.
Well, they may think that that's... Some countries may think that that's what's going to happen. But I think one needs to recognise that we're going to increase the population in Africa by 50% by 2050. It's huge. Another 500 million people or more. Where are they all going to go? I mean,
What are they going to do as
that's
well?
That's right. I mean, in other words, is it like the British model, which was we had all these textile companies building up and we had steelworks and coal mines and so on, and the rural population was flooding into those? I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no evidence that it's happening on a scale that's able to accommodate the kind of increases.
And then
that
you're going to have
about.
To cope with this enormous numbers of people being dispossessed if that's the way you go.
Well, that is all very well, but if countries are leasing these vast tracts of land off for 50 years, They're not going to have the opportunity to explore other models. The deals will have been done, and the deals are being done literally as we speak.
Yeah, well, I think some of the deals are going to be all right. I'm very worried about many of them. Many of the deals have been struck without proper consultation, without recognising who the owners really are.
That was Sir Gordon Conway. Well, we have an interview with one of the big players in African agribusiness. Neil Crowder is the chief executive of an investment fund called Chaitin Africa. Chaitin Africa is developing big farms in Zambia and other African countries. He says farming in Africa can be very profitable. Just wait till you hear how much he expects investors will make. But will it also benefit Africans?
We are solely focused on feeding Africa. All of our production that we're doing to date is sold locally into the African markets. And this is obviously a sensitive topic because there are investors, many sovereign countries, looking to Africa as a way of potentially meeting their own long-term food security issues. But Africa itself needs an increased production. The economies are growing, which means incomes are rising and people are changing what they're eating. Africa needs to increase production for its own consumption.
But listen, you're sounding a bit like an NGO. I mean, I'm an investor coming to you with money. You know, I want to know where the profit is. If I can sell your, you know, the output of one of your farms for more on the open market, why on earth wouldn't I do that?
Well, this is a bit unfortunate. But because Africa is importing food and because transportation costs are high, generally the price for the product we're selling, which is basic food, is higher in Central Africa than it is worldwide. And again,
so actually the best markets for your produce are in Africa because the price is higher.
That's certainly our view.
Why are you obviously a little uncomfortable about this? I mean, this makes it a straightforward opportunity for people.
I'm absolutely not uncomfortable with what we're doing. We're providing a demand for a local market, and through that it should lead to lower prices over time. I'm not uncomfortable with that at all.
But, I mean, there are issues, obviously, with farming in Africa. There are quite a lot of farmers already in Africa. How do you find land that isn't being farmed?
Our model is what we call a brownfield approach, which is we're buying existing commercial farms, many of the farms that haven't had the capital needed to make them efficient, and improving the efficiency. And the idea is to aggregate some of the existing commercial farms into a large-scale commercial farming business.
There's a huge amount of contest about land ownership, even on long-established farms, aren't there? I mean, aren't the problems with local people claiming that you're kind of, I don't know, grabbing the land?
Actually, we have not found that. And
You haven't had problems?
Not at all. The land ownership issue varies greatly from country to country, and this is one of the things that we need to educate our investors about. We're investing in Zambia, and unfortunately, every time I start talking to a Western investor about Zambia, what they vision in their head is Zimbabwe. But you couldn't find two markets that are very different in terms of land ownership. The risks vary from country to country, but in many countries we're looking at, there's actually a relatively secure framework for investing in land.
Well, there is if the government stays. I mean, what happens if the government falls? I mean, again, I come back to the point that, you know, agricultural ownership of land is an absolutely central issue in all societies. And if you've got a venture capital firm from abroad that owns swathes of your country, I mean, you're going to be, you know, liable to be targeted if there is an upset politically, aren't you?
Potentially. I think it varies from country to country.
But, you know, how do you offset political risk? Because investors must ask you about that.
Well, we have a very specific approach. We work with the World Bank, and the World Bank has underwritten our assets for political risk.
Hold on a second. The World Bank has given you some kind of insurance against the government changing and the attitudes towards you changing.
Correct. We have a relatively unique agreement with the World Bank that we pay a premium for insurance, and they guarantee against expropriation.
I'm slightly surprised that the World Bank offers such insurance policies.
No, because what we're doing is very there's a big development impact in what we're doing.
But hold on, coming back to this this guarantee that you've been offered given by the World Bank, this kind of insurance. I mean, that means in a sense there's no risk attached to your business in Zambia.
There's all kinds of risks with investing, and we've tried to mitigate as many as we can. And my own view in Zambia that we don't need the insurance. We've been very
pleasant.
But
you pay for it.
We do pay for it, and the reason we do that is because our investors are concerned about it.
Okay, well, let me put another scenario to you. I mean, say there's some kind of drought and food becomes scarce in Zambia, but your efficient farm is still producing output. What happens then? I mean, the government's going to want your food, isn't it, to distribute to the people. I mean, what do you do in that sort of situation?
Again, I think our political risk insurance protects us against civil disturbance or inability to use the assets for any reason and expropriation, so I think we're protected.
Listen, I want some of this insurance. Where can I sign up?
We've been very pleased with the World Bank and their involvement. It's not easy to get.
But presumably, I mean, that land was being used by other people, and there are people displaced. How many people would be displaced, you know, in your enterprises,
we have a policy, there's no displacement. And in fact, to get the World Bank involved, they're very obviously focused on the impact you're having and making sure the impact of your investment is positive. We're taking existing farms, maybe mid-sized, and it may be Zambian-owned, and maybe a Zimbabwean who moved up after they had problems in Zimbabwe.
But you're saying, I mean, in as much as people have been displaced, they were displaced so long ago that they, you know, there's no longer dispute about land ownership.
That may be true. It is the case we're doing no displacement. But at the same time, this whole topic, and I don't want to defend land grabs. I'm certainly not doing that. My view is Africa needs to modernize its agriculture. Africa is importing 50 million tons of food per year, even though it has some of the best soils, access to water, and agricultural productivity has not increased for 30 years. And it's a sensitive issue. It has to be done in a sensitive way and in a transparent way, but it's going to be important for Africa.
What's interesting here, because, I mean, in a sense, that's a very kind of subtle, low-key version, presumably, of the investment pitch you make to potential investors. But you presumably, when you do it to investors, you emphasize a little more, like there are actually some big opportunities for people who get in early on in this process, you know, get access to some good land and set up effective farms.
Yes, that is true. I think we are doing a frontier investing, and investors, for the use of their capital, they will want to be compensated.
Well, exactly. They're going to want quite big returns as well because, the higher the risk, the higher the returns. And what kind of returns can they expect?
We are expecting an 18% cash on cash.
Per year?
Per year, yes.
Not bad. So is this a land grab or a great development opportunity for Africa? What do you think? world.business@bbc.co.uk.